From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. 35 years ago this month, one word was on the minds and lips of American moviegoers. On June 20th, 1975, Jaws opened in theaters across the country. It starred Roy Scheider, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Shaw, and Bruce the Mechanical Shark. In the film, the three men find themselves on an obsessive search for a man-eating great white. Well, NPR's Corey Turner recently found himself in the same boat, hunting for Bruce.
Jaws terrified me so much as a kid that it didn't occur to me the shark was fake. Then I found a photo of Bruce being built, a workman leaning harmlessly into his mouth. And that was my Heart of Darkness moment. At 10 years old, I decided, A, I had to see this Bruce for myself, and B, I had to touch him. Why? Simple. How dangerous is a shark you can touch? Here's the problem. I couldn't talk my folks into helping me track Bruce down. So I had to wait until this spring.
So this head right here measured 6 foot, 8 inches, and 400 pounds is weighed, and that's strictly the head?
That's Jeff Pertle, manager of archives and collections at NBC Universal. Universal made Jaws, and we're in Pertle's office on the Universal lot. He's showing me schematics for the original Bruces. There were actually three. One was pulled by boat, when the shark had to swim convincingly. The other two sat atop a metal arm, hidden underwater, so they could, among other things, vault onto the deck of the Orca and make short work of Robert Shaw. The width of those famous jaws? Nearly 5 feet. As for length?
That's a 20-footer.
25.
Finally, the name Bruce came from director Steven Spielberg after his lawyer, Bruce Raymer. It's hard to believe, watching the film, but Bruce the Mechanical Shark had one dirty little secret.
Wherever you were on the island, you could hear the radio mics. And they were always saying, the shark is not working.
That's Richard Dreyfuss in a documentary on the making of Jaws. Joe Alves, the movie's art director, was hired to create the shark. As Bruce's proud father, Alves admits the shark was finicky, but...
When it worked, it was just great. I mean, when it first comes out of the water, when Scheider looks and he says,
I can go slow ahead. Come on down and chum some of this.
And you look, and the shark comes up. I mean, it was just fantastic.
So what happened to Bruce? I took my question straight to the top, to Spielberg himself. Well, actually, I got his spokesman, Marvin Levy, who's been working with Spielberg since Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
The original Bruces were all destroyed.
I held out hope. Maybe there was something hiding in a warehouse somewhere, or an archive.
There's none hiding in a warehouse somewhere. There's none in an archive somewhere.
Marvin's a good guy and a straight shooter, but I thought, maybe he just didn't ask Spielberg.
I got this directly from Steven when I posed you a question.
Directly from Steven. Destroyed. But when? And why? Art director Joe Alves says by the time they finished shooting Jaws, they were so over budget and over schedule that Bruce just wasn't a priority.
We were in deep trouble. The studio was reluctant in the first place to make the movie. When we came back, they just dumped the sharks in the back lot, and they just rotted away.
Heartbroken, I went to Facebook. Believe it or not, Bruce the Mechanical Shark has his own Facebook page, and more friends than I ever will. And many of those friends still hold out hope that he's alive. I mean, intact. And it's there, on Facebook, that I first heard about a possible fourth Bruce. It sounded too good to believe, so I asked Jeff Pertle, the NBC Universal archivist.
The fourth shark was originally brought to my attention probably 2 years ago by a Jaws fan who had found my phone number and said the fourth Jaws shark was in existence at an auto parts junkyard in Sun Valley.
Now, this fourth shark was not used in the film, but it does appear to have been cast from the original Bruce mold at the time of the film, before the mold was lost. The shark hung by its tail at Universal Studios' theme park in Hollywood from 1975 to 1990. So, what happened to this fourth Bruce? I started cold calling junkyards. The conversations all went something like this. Hi, I'm calling from NPR. Do you happen to have a shark in your junkyard? Yeah, a shark. Hello? Until a few calls into my list, when the guy on the other end of the line didn't hang up on me.
I'm Nathan Adlin, Adlin Brothers Auto Wrecking in Sun Valley, California.
Nathan inherited the business from his father, Sam Adlin, who in 1990 was buying vehicles from Universal's transportation department. Now, Nathan doesn't know exactly how it happened. His father died more than 10 years ago. All he knows is, one day, lumped into a huge batch of cars at Universal, was a shark.
It caught my father's eye. I'm hearing it secondhand that when it got here, it was a little bit damaged. I think we added the teeth back to it and whatever else needed mending.
I flew across the country and headed for Sun Valley. But I had to be sure this was Bruce. So I brought a little help. The man who designed him, Joe Alves. And Alves brought his friend, Roy Arbogast, whom he had hired to help create the original Bruce mold. Nathan Adlin leads us through a compound of buildings, through a garage, and then, finally, two large gates. And there he is.
That's it.
Standing in the middle of five palm trees. In front of us is a sea of junked cars, 26 acres worth, and a tiny oasis of palms and loquat plants. In the middle of that oasis, atop two metal poles, is a shark. His skin is cracked, his color badly faded. Instead of rows of menacing teeth, he has harmless wooden dentures. But, as Joe points out, the size is right.
You know what amazes me, though, seeing it? How big the damn thing is.
But is it Bruce? Joe thinks so, but defers to Roy Arbogast. Roy walks under the belly of the beast, poking it with the handle of a rake. Then he stops and says something to himself. What was that, Roy?
That's the real one.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You're pretty sure, huh?
Yeah, definitely. It's from the same mold.
Just looking at it, can you tell me what about it strikes you?
No, it's just kind of nice to see it again after 25 or 30 years. It's amazing that it's still here.
It's older than I am, and though I'm not 10 anymore, I just can't help myself. It's too tempting. Nathan has been kind enough to give me a ladder, and we've put it just below the shark. I'm walking up the ladder. My head is officially in his mouth, and I am now touching the shark. Corey Turner, NPR News, Sun Valley, California.
And you can see a family album that we've put together of the four Bruces at our website, npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The explosion of that oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico 6 weeks ago has created more than an environmental disaster. It's also leading, for some, to a financial disaster. Yesterday alone, BP stock plunged 15%. We'll remind you here that this company is a British firm with a long and storied history and with many investors in Britain who are feeling the pain now. Vicky Barker reports.
BP is a giant on Britain's business landscape. It accounts for some 6% of the value of London's FTSE 100 index. It's also the country's biggest dividend payer. BP says it accounts for $1 out of every $7 paid into British pension funds by British companies. Analyst Tom McPhail had this warning for Britain's retirees.
You see that oil flowing out into the Gulf. It's not just an environmental disaster. That is your retirement income that's flowing out into the Gulf there.
The bad news for Britain's seniors is that the market seem to be betting not just that the spill and the accompanying cleanup and legal costs will balloon even further, but that BP may ultimately have to withdraw from the U.S. entirely. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
At the end of the school year, teenage girls often head to the tanning salon, hoping to look fit and glowing in their prom dresses. But evidence is mounting that too much indoor tanning increases the risk of skin cancer. As NPR's Patty Naiman reports, the Food and Drug Administration is taking steps to make sure that teens take the risk seriously.
It was right before the prom 8 years ago. 17-year-old Brittany Sakala was really excited. She was going with the boy she would eventually marry, and her dress, well, it was beautiful. Delicately beaded lace and spaghetti straps and elegant A-line in white.
Everyone around me was telling me, man, you would look so much better with a tan, and your teeth would look whiter, your acne would go away.
So pale-skinned Brittany did what lots of her friends did. She did what a lot of teens in the U.S. do. She went to a tanning salon. In fact, she went to the salon 5, 6, often 7 days a week, and lay in the tanning bed for 20 to 25 minutes each time.
I called myself a tanorexic because I would look into the mirror and never see myself as dark as other people would see me, much as an anorexic would never see themselves as thin as other people would see them. So I kept going.
Tanorexic? Yes. That's what a study from psychologist Catherine Mosher of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center recently confirmed. Mosher analyzed data from more than 420 college students and had them answer questions typically used to screen for alcohol and substance abuse, but modified to ask about tanning habits.
Do you try to cut down on the time you spend in tanning beds or booths, but find yourself still tanning? Do you ever feel guilty that you're using tanning beds or booths too much?
Mosher found the majority of kids answered yes to one or more of these questions, which target addictive behavior. After 3 years of routine indoor tanning, Brittany Sakala ended up with a serious health problem.
My mom noticed a mole on my back about the size of a nickel the summer of 2004. She kept bugging me about it. Brittany, that doesn't look right. You really should go get that checked out.
But Brittany stalled and kept tanning. Then the mole started to bleed. Her doctor took one look at the mole and scheduled a biopsy for the next morning. Brittany had melanoma, the most aggressive form of skin cancer. 2 weeks later, she had surgery to remove the mole, which left a 7-inch scar. Since then, Brittany's had 34 surgeries to remove suspicious moles. Robin Hornung is a pediatric dermatologist in Washington State. She says rates of melanoma are growing fastest among younger women, 15 to 29 years old, and researchers want to understand why.
The question is, why is that happening? But a lot of folks would point to perhaps indoor tanning. That's the group that makes up most of the indoor tanners, are the young women.
Federal officials say as many as 1 in 5 teenagers, mostly girls, have used a tanning bed over the past year. And while teens may think of a tan as a healthy glow, Hornung says it's the body's reaction to injury.
We know that a tan is really your skin's response to ultraviolet light damage. DNA breaks. There are mutations in the DNA. And when you get breaking of the DNA, you actually have a tan is a kind of a healing response.
A recent study found melanoma risk increased as much as 3 times if people tanned indoors more than 50 hours in their lifetime or had more than 100 sessions in a tanning booth. The World Health Organization recently classified tanning beds as carcinogenic and recommended children under 18 be banned from using them. A number of countries have already put such bans in place, and the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates the tanning industry in the U.S., says it's also considering a ban. FDA official Sharon Miller says the agency definitely plans to strengthen warning labels on the beds themselves.
We're planning to use a bulleted format and just be more direct and say that UV can cause skin cancer. You know, not draw it out and make it seem like only people who really abuse it are going to get skin cancer, because we think any exposure does contribute to your risk of skin cancer.
The FDA may also require parents to approve tanning for kids under 18. John Overstreet with the Indoor Tanning Association says bans are intrusive and represent overregulation.
I think the industry is a great deal more professional than it was 25 years ago. So there's a lot of information available to these businesses that allow them to advise people about how long they should be in the tanning bed without getting overexposed.
Meanwhile, since her own illness, cancer survivor Brittany Sakala has made skin cancer awareness her personal mission. She's testified about tanning and cancer risk at FDA hearings and at medical conferences. But by far the most important work she does, says Sakala, is at local high schools where she tells young girls her story about indoor tanning and cancer. Patty Niemand, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. BP is doing risky underwater work today. It's trying to cut through a heavy riser in its latest effort to capture some of the oil that's been gushing into the Gulf of Mexico. So far, the risk has not paid off. The saw being used got stuck in the pipe earlier today. Oil has now washed ashore in at least three states, and Florida is likely next. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
After weeks of looming offshore, the orangey-brown crude is now fouling beaches and marshes from Louisiana to Alabama. Louisiana has been hardest hit so far, but since yesterday, signs of the pollution have shown up on barrier islands in Mississippi and Alabama. Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour says a strand of caramel-colored emulsified oil came on shore on Pettyboy Island, south of Pascagoula.
It's like 2 miles long, but about a yard wide and not solid, apparently.
Barbour says this is the first significant amount of oil to hit Mississippi and warns it won't be the last. He's calling for stronger offshore defenses to prevent oil from reaching the coast.
This hopefully was a wake-up call for us.
It's increasingly clear that there's no stopping what's coming. The oil on Pettyboy came up from under the surface, so it wasn't detected by overflights. Patches of oil have also hit Dauphin Island, Alabama, south of Mobile. Further east, in Orange Beach, near the Florida border, tar balls have washed ashore, and streams of oil are just about 6 miles out in the Gulf. It's coming at the worst possible time, the start of the summer tourist season. At a town hall meeting in the city gym, local officials pressed BP for a commitment to pay local businesses who've been hurt by the oil spill. Former BP CFO Paul Basham was booed when he dodged the direct request.
Well, I'll certainly give a commitment that I will work hard to achieve each of your complaints.
Restaurant owner Regina Shipp says she's been through four adjusters since filing a claim for a $10,000 loss at the end of April.
They're not doing what they say. President Obama is getting on TV saying, we will make BP pay you. President Obama, they're not paying.
She worries how businesses will stay afloat here.
You know, Orange Beach is a tourist town. You know, my husband and I moved our family here because it's a tourist town and we're restaurant tourists and that's where you make your money off tourists. If the tourists die, the town dies. It'll be a ghost town.
Orange Beach Mayor Tony Kennan says the town knows how to handle a natural disaster, but not this.
This, unfortunately, is just a black cloud that's just hovering, and we all feel helpless in that we just don't feel like we have any ability to affect the change or be part of ending this. It's a very frustrating feeling.
It's a frustration that's spreading with the oil all along the Gulf Coast. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
Our book critic, Alan Chews, himself a novelist, created his own little book club this spring, one that focuses on thrillers. He has read himself through the newest batch of commercial contenders for Best Rip-Roaring Narrative, and here's what he found.
I want to begin by saying, with respect to the posthumous multi-million-dollar success by the Swedish writer Stieg Larsson, how sorry I am that it's over. The final volume in his really engaging trilogy about crime and corruption in contemporary Sweden, kind of like the Sopranos of contemporary publishing, has just appeared, and I gobbled it up. This one is called The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. It once again features the young woman named Lisbeth Salander, a troubled, young, punkish, probably mildly autistic bisexual heroine with a spine of steel, who in this volume, with the assistance of a Stockholm magazine journalist, completes her battle for personal justice. If you haven't read the first two novels in this trilogy, you're probably wondering why I'm getting so lathered up about a thriller. All I can say is that if you enjoy contemporary thrillers with major, larger-than-life main characters, sharp social commentary, and forward-moving plots, please do pick up these first two volumes and play catch-up. I lingered over the pages of this final installment, languished in them. Just as brilliant, if not more so, is the latest novel from Alan First about the murky nexus of war and espionage in Europe during World War II, his usual material always told with unusual detail and flair. This one, called Spies of the Balkans, takes us to Salonika, just as Mussolini has decided to invade Greece, and carries us along with a mix of convincing details about the place and time and heart-pounding plot-making when the German army also promises to invade. You'll find a celebration of courage in very, very dangerous times when Salonika police detective Costa Zanis, the novel's main character, finds it a moral necessity to set up an escape route for fugitives from the Third Reich. In the novel The Good Son, writer Michael Gruber turns the tale of an American Taliban on its head and gives us a Taliban American. He's Theo Lagari, born in the Punjab in Pakistan to an American mother and a Pakistani father, a jihadist war hero before puberty, and now a member of our own special forces. As the novel opens, Theo has returned to the U.S. for reassignment. He makes a quick turnaround because his mother, Sonia, a Muslim convert from Catholicism and a Jungian analyst by training, has been kidnapped in Pakistan by a gang of criminal terrorists. The plan Theo concocts to rescue his mom and a half dozen of her colleagues nearly turns U.S. South Asia policy around. The biggest commercial offering this spring, prize-winning writer Justin Cronin's vampire novel, The Passage, turns out to be the biggest disappointment. The book is a multi-million-dollar clunker and nearly 800 pages long to boot. It's a vampire novel. Cronin got a lot of money up front for this story that began when his young daughter supposedly suggested he write a scary book. He came up with a U.S. military experiment that creates a horde of infectious, murderous bloodsuckers and America collapsing around their fangs. I'm not saying don't give it a try. I just want to tell you that I wasn't at all sorry when this one was over.
Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University. He reviewed Stieg Larsson's The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, Alan First's Spies of the Balkans, Michael Gruber's The Good Son, and Justin Cronin's The Passage. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. School districts around the country are planning massive layoffs as they struggle to close big budget deficits. And when it comes to choosing which teachers must go, many districts can use only one factor to guide them, seniority. And as NPR's Larry Abramson reports, that means many schools will have to cast out effective teachers.
Like many of his counterparts, Cleveland School's CEO Eugene Sanders is facing a monster spending gap, $54 million wide. According to Sanders, there's no room left to trim, and he may have to shed over 500 teachers. He says that when he sent out pink slips earlier this year, he had no flexibility.
The last hired are the first ones to go, without regard to productivity, efficiency, accountability, performance, or outcomes.
That means some schools face a complete staff turnover. MC Squared STEM High School, with its freshman campus located at the Great Lakes Science Center, is only 2 years old. It has attracted lots of teachers new to the Cleveland School District.
This is my first year in the district, and because of layoffs, my last.
Krista Krohn is one of those perky, vivacious teachers every parent wants for their child. She's actually been teaching math for 8 years total, but her service in other districts does not count here. The RIF is all the more painful because she and other promising teachers were specially recruited to work in an innovative, science-focused school, Cleveland's best hope to improve student performance.
When you recruit someone and you pink slip them, it's just not right. You just don't do that to people.
The principal of this school, Jeff McClellan, laboriously hammered out a special memorandum of understanding with the Cleveland Teachers Union so that he could interview and hire the staff he wanted. Teachers agreed to work all summer in this year-round school, but McClellan couldn't touch seniority because it is written into state law. Now, all but two of his 12 teachers will be canned.
The unfortunate thing is we've invested, you know, on average about 430 to 440 hours of professional development around our model. You know, even people who are interested that come in aren't going to necessarily have had that kind of training up front.
Ohio is one of 15 states where, by law, seniority rules the day when layoffs are necessary, and many local contracts help perpetuate the decades-old love affair with seniority. Why give absolute preference to teachers who have simply stayed in one district for longer? David Kolke, president of the Cleveland Teachers Union, says experience should be valued.
There's this notion that somehow experience is a bad thing.
It's one of the few professions we kind of talk about it as being a bad thing.
Many states are starting to revamp their systems for evaluating teachers so that student progress will play a bigger role. But those changes won't affect seniority-based layoffs, which don't take evaluations into account. And David Quilkey says there is a good reason to stick with seniority. Without an objective criterion for judging teachers, he says the game would be totally rigged in favor of younger, less expensive teachers.
That an individual, administrator, district, certainly when you're facing tough economic times, are going to say, you know, by the way, Quilkey, you know, your salary is $20,000 more, and I think the $20,000 less teacher is better quality.
That's largely the position of the national teachers unions. With teacher layoffs unavoidable in countless districts, the seniority question will be front and center in the coming weeks as final budget totals determine how many people must go. Some research indicates the primacy of seniority is making this whole process much more painful. Marguerite Rosa of the University of Washington says that when districts have to riff younger, cheaper employees, they have to get rid of more teachers to balance their budgets.
So you have to lay off more people in order to close a targeted gap than if you were to lay off neutral to salary.
Rosa also says high-poverty schools feel the biggest impact from seniority-based layoffs because those schools tend to have the least experienced teachers. A coalition of education groups is urging Congress to include an anti-seniority provision in a proposed federal program to save teachers' jobs. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.